St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Columbia, Missouri, believes in continuing Christian education. They also believe in inclusion of all people, of all races, and of all gender identities. During the 2020 season of Lent, Reverend C.W. Dawson uses the book titled The Cross and the Lynching Tree by author Dr. James Cone to hold an open conversation about race and religion. For the next hour, enjoy and contemplate what speaks to you during his fourth and final conversation on March 29, 2020, held online with St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Columbia.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you all for being here today. Again, thank you and the committee for allowing this opportunity of conversation about race to happen within the confines of St. Andrew's. And Pastor, thank you for being supportive. And
you're welcome.
Being today my tech man, to help make sure we are all on board here. Thanks, all of you, for joining in this morning. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Eternal God, our Father and our Mother, we give you thanks and praise for this day, a beautiful day, a windy, cool day, in which we get to celebrate you in the altars and at the altars of our heart. We thank you for this opportunity. We bless your name that you have allowed us to gather and to engage in this conversation about that which has divided us since 16 and 19, and now that which may serve as the platform to unite us. God, we ask that you continue to bless in the midst of this pandemic. Keep us safe, keep us healthy. Bless our brothers and sisters, not only in this community and in the United States, but around the world. God, we need a healing touch. And so now we ask that you bless this assembly, that the things we do and say might be pleasing in your sight. Hold us, God, in the palm of your hand, and we'll make sure we give you the thanks and the praise. I ask it in the name of my Master, Yeshua, Jesus. And in his name we pray, and the people of God said, amen. So I want to begin by, again, thanking all of you for this opportunity. And I need to acknowledge some folks who have really been helpful in putting together the Lenten study. St. Matthew's Episcopal Church out of Manhattan in New York, they did a study with Dr. Cone about for Lent, and some of the things they did I found to be very, very helpful. And then, of course, the Conference Board for Church and Society with the United Methodist Church, as you all know, Dr. Cone attended the UMC Seminary in Chicago, Garrett Theological, and even though he was an AME, African Methodist Episcopal participant, he did do lots of work with the United Methodist Church. And so they've been very helpful in formulating this conversation. So I have to acknowledge them, because I was telling Pastor David one time, I went to hear a guy preach in Philadelphia. I was there, preached the rest of that week on revival, but on that Tuesday, we decided to go hear him. And the guy preached one of my sermons verbatim and never did even say, thank you, Dawson, or acknowledge me, any of that. So I'm always very careful that when I use, borrow ideas from other people and things, Erica, I make sure I tell people I got it from so-and-so. I know y'all hear me with that. It's a bad thing to take for somebody, don't even acknowledge the gift. So anyway, thanks to them for their help in this. Let's begin a little differently today. Pastor, if you would please, let's hear some Billie Holiday.
All right.
and we increase the volume.
Swing it in the southern breeze. Strain from the poplar tree. Pastoral scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a string and bitter.
Thank you, Pastor.
You're welcome.
Of course, that's the great Billie Holiday. Allegedly that she was on the train leaving New York, going to perform in the, what was called then the Children's Circuit. And in her travels, she was looking out of the train, and she could see bodies hanging from trees in different parts of the journey, which made her write Strange Fruit. Now, in reading chapter 5, a couple of things strike us. One is that Cone seems to suggest that that the blues is unique because it's able to speak to the dichotomy of our faith tradition, right? One of the characteristics he says about the blues is that it can speak to both the tragic and the comic, sorrow and joy simultaneously. And I found that to be consistent with the blues, whether it's Muddy Waters or B.B. King or Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, on and on. I like those people. Anyway, that music has a way of both arresting our pain and at the same time giving us some joy and even some humor. One of the old blues songs, I believe, from Muddy Waters, but my mama and she might be jiving too. The blues had a way of addressing and speaking to the deeper parts of the human experience. Question then is our faith like that? Is our faith given to us in such a way that it can speak to both the sorrows and the joys of the Christian experience? One of the things that all of us have been very, very uncomfortable with is that with the evangelicals, it always wants to tell me about the joy prize of being Christian, the hope of Christian victory, that if I just read my Bible and if I just stay within the assembly, I won't have to worry about, I can abdicate myself from the sorrows of the world, the realities of the lived experience. On the flip side, some of my Pentecostal friends remind me so much about the tragic dilemma, the tragic narrative in the lived experience, that they forget to tell me about what are the joys of living in this spirit? What are the transformations? What are the miraculous that I have seen in the Christian experience? The blues has a way of doing both. Unfortunately, you know, some folks are so heavenly bound, they know earthly good. And so music like that was called demonic music or the devil's music. It's amazing to me how what some people call demonic ends up being salvific. The blues. And is the blues something that we ought to investigate in the contemporary era? I listen to hip hop, but I can't listen to it too much. Can I get a witness from somebody? Just wave your hand or shake your head or something. You know, all women are the B word, and it's about acquisition, shooting, money, on and on and on. I even have a problem with some of the contemporary church music. For instance, one of the songs is Let's Get Back to Eden. And that's an old one, but it's still a good one. And people still think like that, a return to Eden. Seems to me the Christian experience is not a return to Eden, but the Christian experience ought to be moving towards Zion. And the movement towards Zion ought to be the transformation of the whole world. Jesus pray, right, on earth as it is in heaven. Mm-hmm. So, how then is it recapturing the blues? Do we recapture something about the essential nature of the Christian faith? In this chapter, Dr. Cone draws attention to the fact that women were also the victims of lynching, both directly and indirectly. We always get the narrative about the men who were lynched, but very seldom do we, and we need to, remember that women were the victims of lynching as well. Same kind of thing. Rape and torture, body mutilation, breasts cut off, etc. And then raped again with foreign objects. And then finally lynched, and then set on fire. Now, many of American historians say only about 2% were actually lynched. It would be a mistake to assume that the violence against women was not widespread and brutal. What other kinds of violence were women subjected to? How about the fact that during a time of segregation, many women had to sleep with the employer in order that their mate might be safe? Or what about being subjective to the names in which people were called that were dehumanizing and estranging? Women, too, struggled to maintain faith in God in the midst of so much suffering and injustice, males and females. Identify strongly with the biblical characters. Challenge. Esther was living in the house, doing just fine. Trouble starts coming, and she is told, you cannot avoid this. Perhaps you were called for such a time as this. Or how about wise older women helping younger women survive? So one of the stories that were told immediately in the little black church I grew up in is a story of Ruth and her mother-in-law, Naomi. In fact, my mama and them and her little group, all of them were about 5 feet tall and 5 feet wide. It was the black church. Y'all ought to help me here. And they would always say to the young guys, if you want to find a good woman, you better talk to us. Such as the story of Naomi, right? And Ruth, that Naomi first says, you know, go on about your business. I don't have any more sons. I'm too old to have any more sons. And by the time they grow up, you'd be too old to be with them. And she tells her, no, your God will be my God. Your people will be my people. And they travel together. Y'all know the story. That Naomi recognizes that Boaz is interested in her. What comes from that? That the wisdom of those who have lived a long time is necessary for the younger to survive. I like bad comics. Y'all pray for me. Don't talk about me. But one of them is Richard Pryor. And Richard Pryor once said that there's a lot of young folk think they're smart living in the cemetery, pushing up daisies, that you don't get to be old by being a fool. And so one of the things that was always pushed during this time of segregation, of times of dehumanization, is listen to your elders. There's something about the fact they've been able to survive that ought to be helpful to you in the present. All right. Identifying how as a preacher with people like Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, who cries over Israel, particularly Jerusalem. Old Jerusalem, old Jerusalem. I mean, Jesus picks it up, right? Old Jerusalem, old Jerusalem, how you kill and eat your prophets. Think about preachers in the South, particularly, who had to preach under threat of violence against them. And yet, the challenge was, may I borrow from a Lutheran song? Though the body they may kill, that in spite of threat of terror, and remember Martin, this is a marvelous scene in my mind. Remember Martin when his house was being attacked and being bombed, he said he was under the bed with a flashlight reading Paul Tillich's Courage to Be while they were shooting and bombing his house. Why? Because he understood, like the prophets of old, that thus saith the Lord, in spite of the fact that it could end up in your personal tragedy. Question. What biblical characters do you identify with? How do they help you in the struggle, right? In the struggle. Many folks came from, at least in the church I grew up in, and Cone points to this in the chapter, that the kind of identification with particular biblical stories have helped them to deal with difficult situations in their life. They come up with then a conversation, an articulation of that faith, such as, God may not come when you want it, but God is always right on time.
How about,
Lord will make a way out of no way? Or how about songs like Trouble in My Way make you cry sometime? Trouble in my way make you cry sometime. But I know that Jesus will fix it after a while. Has your own faith given you in the tragedies and the struggles you've gone to? What declarations have you come up with, such that it articulates a faith in the midst of struggle? And by the way, that conversation is really poignant and on page 125. The faith of Black women gave them courage to fight, patience when they could not, and the hope that whatever they did, God would keep them from sinking down. Page 125. On 139, Howard Thurman is quoted. And Thurman says, a person has to handle suffering or be handled by it. That's provocative to me. You either handle suffering or you are handled by suffering. I was thinking in my mind about this COVID virus stuff. And I don't know if y'all do the Facebook thing. But so many stories coming out about don't touch the handle of the gas station. It's an attack against people of color. It's the sign of the end world, of the end times, that we all getting ready to die and go somewhere. On and on and on and on. In my book, that's being handled by suffering. Now, I want to kind of backtrack a little bit what I think both Howard Thurman and Cone are talking about in handling suffering or being handled by suffering. Ever since 16 and 19, African Americans have been faced with the following questions. Number one, do we stay in America? Is this a place that ultimately will receive our full personhood? Or as written in the cornerstone of the Second Baptist Church in Kansas City, is this a place where I might find some praying ground to meet with my Lord? Do we stay? Is it ever really going to change? Or should we stay? And if we don't stay, where are we going to go? You all know Liberia was a country formed by African Americans. Liberia was to be a place where we could leave and have our own ground. Remember, Talbert, when he was president, William Talbert was constantly calling African Americans to, quote, come back home. Marcus Garvey. My grandfather on my mother's side used to send a quarter every week to the Black Star Liner so that he might have a seat in the Back to Africa movement. Do we stay? Number two, and if we stay, how do we stay? Do we stay and assimilate so that people like Booker T. Washington were constantly telling African Americans that the more they look like, act like, spoke like Anglo-America, that eventually they would be accepted. And so if you remember in the early integration movement under Dr. King, notice that his conversation, notice that it was a way of integration was to be a process of assimilation of African Americans in the greater Anglo culture. The music, for instance, was a way of assimilation. So at Bethune-Cookman, when I was there, they had two choirs. They had the chancel choral, which sang spiritual. And W.E.B. Du Bois said that one of the ways we can prove that we are both African and American is that we ought to sing spirituals and not gospel, not long meter hymns. Guide me, O thou great Jehovah, pilgrim in despairing land, is a long meter hymn that W.E.B. Du Bois said, that's too like slavery, much like slavery. Sing spirituals. Or do we stay, but we say separate, such that you will remember that before, even before Minister Farrakhan, call was to create a black state in the midst of America. Elijah Muhammad, who was leader of the Nation of Islam, and J.H. Jackson, who was president of the largest African-American Christian denomination in the United States, the National Baptist Convention USA Incorporated, at one point joined money together in order to create a black state. They were buying up land in places like Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Georgia, in order to create a black state. Why am I mentioning this? Because some people want to argue to be black and Christian in America is to create a separate community, not interested in integrating to or with the Anglo community. The question then again, what does it mean for me to be black and Christian and deal with the suffering that comes in U.S.? Do I leave? Do I stay? And if I stay, do I assimilate? Or do I stay and separate? I think I see a question. Is there a question?
Yes, we've got a question from Erica. She's asking about black liberation theology, and saying, am I right to think that it is following Christ but rejecting the message of be patient and you will be rewarded in heaven for your suffering here? So instead, black liberation theology encourages struggle and reach for your happiness, and God will still love you, and you are worthy of a good life here on earth.
Right. Erica, I think you're right. I think a very important tenet of black liberation theology was to throw off the struggles, to throw off the chains that kept us in struggle. Notice, if you please, with James Forman, who was part of the early formation of black liberation theology. My favorite story is James Forman. They put together, for it, first of all, what was called the Black Manifesto. And the Black Manifesto stated a couple of things. One is that white America, white church America, owed black people reparations, that they were to create a black state. So, and on and on. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to look at the Black Manifesto, you can just pull that up on YouTube. You'll find it very easily. His foreman walked into the Great Riverside Church. I'm sure you all remember the God Box used to be there on the Hudson River. That was where the majority of traditional denominations had their headquarters. God Box, Hudson River. Right across the street is the Riverside. And so James Forman one Sunday morning walked into the Riverside and said, excuse me, in the middle of the worship, you all will not have worship today. In fact, you need to give me the offering. And so then he laid out the Black Manifesto. Here's the thing that happened. Ladies and gentlemen, you won't believe this. They gave him the offering, not only in that first early sermon service, but the second one and the third one is the Riverside. And you would be amazed how many Anglo churches participated in supporting the Black Manifesto. Liberation theology is in two parts. First was that it was to address the various structures that hold people in oppression. That's James Cone, that's Deotus Roberts, James Washington, all of those who participate in first generation liberation theology. The mistake they made, however, was that they used Anglo metaphysical categories to try to explain liberation, what liberation meant. So, for instance, with James Cone, in his early work, he talks about there are two kinds of churches, a white church and a black church. A black church is a church that stands on the side of justice, liberation, and freedom. A white church is a church that supports the status quo. What happens is you get a very confusing metaphysic. So you could be black in color, but white church. So you end up with black white churches, Clarence Thomas, and you end up with white black churches, St. Andrews. Now, how do you start to sort that out? And that was one of the problems in liberation theology made in the first. Second big one is it did not articulate, are there any times in which violence is not a tool to be used? Now, with Martin was about, as you know, nonviolent direct action, right? I protest, I give my body, I suffer. Malcolm was not about that. Malcolm, who I also think was a liberation theologian, Malcolm said that we are fighting not to integrate into society nor separate from society, but we are fighting to live as free human beings in this society, quote, unquote. There are times in which violence becomes necessary in order to defend ourselves against radical evil. When do we not? And is nonviolent direct action the only tool we should use, or are there others? That, ladies and gentlemen, is what I call first generation liberation theology. I think second generation liberation theology says it is not just the purpose of the church to be prophetic. It's also the purpose of the church to be pastoral. So yes, the church ought to stand over and against the powers, the systems, the principalities that attempt to hold people in bondage, black people in bondage, but it also should minister nurse to those who have been wounded and broken in the struggle. First generation theology did not speak about that at all. Second generation theology, I think, does. The second thing is first generation liberation theology was sexist and homophobic, that it did not make room for women in the struggle, which is why you get people who put together what's now called womanist theology. Womanist different from feminist theology. Feminists say that, yes, there needs to be a change and women need to lead it without men. Womanist theology says, yes, there needs to be a change and women need to lead it, but men can come along if they act right. That's a Dawson part. And so womanist theology, first coined by, you remember, Alice Walker in her book, In My Mother's Garden, I think that's the name of the book, talks about womanism and black theologians, black women, picked that up and put together what is called womanism as a way of addressing the inadequacies of black liberation theology of the first generation. Second thing is, and ladies and gentlemen, I don't know where you all are about this, but I think I'm part of second generation liberation theology has got to take seriously the suffering and struggles of the gay community. And that's something that black liberation theology did not do in the first. There's always been gay people in the black church. We just acted like they were invisible. And it's ridiculous that we also have to pick up the real narrative that's being presented to us at the LGBTQIA+ community. I think that's important. And so I think that's one of the distinctions of black liberation theology in its development since the very beginning. I hope I answered your question. I didn't give too much, Erica.
If you don't mind, just one other different question. Phil asks wonder about how to think about this book relative to today's slavery. For example, our clothes and consumer goods are made by people paid slave wages now across the world. don't mean to minimize the problem in our society here, but wonder how to put all of these things together from a religious standpoint or perspective.
Well, I think there's a key for us, but I don't know if we've taken it seriously.
Okay.
And that is, we sing, we confess that we are one. We are one in the Spirit. We are one in the Lord. And too often, I think our churches have said, yeah, we're one in the Spirit, but when it comes to economics, that's a whole different thing. I really think that the next generation is going to, well, first of all, this is what we know. The world is more connected now than it ever has been. There are people in all parts of the world who could, for instance, plug in right now and see this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We are more connected. We are more interdependent than we've ever been. I think the church of the future is going to have to realize that the problems and the issues on the continent of Africa or in South America or in the Caribbean or in Asia are our problems too, and that our struggles are their struggles too. I mean, one of the things that Jesus reminded us of is that a house divided against itself cannot stand. And if we don't start seeing each other as living in the same house, and also as Baldwin talks about, that we're living in a burning house, then we are in trouble. We are in serious trouble. I just want to leave it at that.
Thank you.
And then maybe more of you want to participate in that. Are there other questions at this point? Okay, let me, one of the things that Joan lifts, one more thing, and I've got to hurry because I want to stop so that we can have time for more conversation. But one of the things that Cone talks about in chapter 5 is that that suffering, that our whole idea about atonement, that one of the things that white Western European Anglo-American church says is that suffering is redemptive, right? That the suffering of Jesus upon the cross redeems the whole creation. And that in suffering, redemption is found. Notice what he says, I think it's like page 150. That God snatches victory out of defeat, life out of death, hope out of despair.
Excuse me. It's hard to hear you when you're bent over the book, so you need to.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Speak into
on page 150. He says, what is redemptive is the faith that God snatches victory out of defeat, life out of death, hope out of despair, as revealed in the biblical and black proclamation of Jesus' resurrection. So remember now, one of the ideas, again, think about writers like Gustav Allain, old book, great book, that the suffering is redemptive for the created order. Here's the problem. Is black suffering redemptive? If so, for who? Anthony Penn wrote a book years ago called, it sticks with me, called Oh Lord. And in it, he talks about how African Americans have been taught that just keep on struggling, keep on suffering, that it will redeem the society and the Hawaii world. That's nonviolent. Direct action, is it not? That I'm going to stand even if I'm beaten, if I'm spat upon, if I'm cursed, that my soul power is such that it is redemptive for American society. Martin even talked about the fact that the reason the demonstrations were so successful, like in Birmingham, where you had the dogs and the water hoses, et cetera, is that we had a media that caught it, and it pricked the conscience of America. But how much suffering must folks of color suffer? How much suffering must women suffer? How much suffering should the gay community suffer to redeem America? It doesn't look like the redemptive action is working. I said this earlier in one of the talks, ladies and gentlemen, I really thought by the time I got to be 66 years old, we'd really kind of be past this race stuff. But it's gotten worse. It hadn't gotten better.
Right.
From the president to Mike Parsons, Governor Parsons, telling us, right, that the coronavirus is our fault. That all I got to do is about me. That government can't help. Oh, what? I was talking to one of my gay colleagues, and he was telling me that he was in the store and someone called him a faggot. And I said, man, I understand. Because just last week, somebody called me a nigga. Now, we've gotten worse, ladies and gentlemen. We've gotten worse. And so is our suffering redemptive for America? Is that who we're redeeming? And Penn says in Oh Lord, we got to get out of that mindset of laying my body for the redemption of a culture that cannot be moved by moral persuasion. I don't know where you are politically, but here's a little litmus test for other folk you know. If you bring up an argument against Mr. Trump, for instance, maybe Mr. Trump has moved too slowly with the coronavirus, and that maybe we should have responded earlier so we wouldn't have this rush and panic about ventilators. I'm just using that as an example, just as a conversation. Most conservative people will automatically tell me about what Obama didn't do. We're not talking about Mr. Obama, and that's a very odd way of engaging in dialogue. But somewhere along the line, I guess my point is how much giving of my life and my personhood must I give in order to redeem? Secondly, is it redemptive for me? So when African Americans are lynched and tortured and imprisoned and on and on and on, and across the board, you've heard me say this, it's not just African Americans. I'm talking about people of color. I'm talking about Latinos in cages. I'm talking about Native Americans who have their tribal treaties have been violated over and over and over. Is it redemptive for us? Because in my neighborhood, I'm not seeing people of color feeling redeemed. Remember the text in the Psalms that says, let the redeemed of the Lord say so? Most of the folk of color I know are saying no. And so, what do we mean by redemption, and what do we think about redemption when we think about the suffering of people of color in this society?
I'm wondering if I could jump in.
Sure.
I find myself, I remember it was 3, 4, 5 years ago that I started to see, particularly African American theologians and others starting to say, you know, it's not our responsibility, and this is also for the LGBTQ community, it's not our responsibility to educate white people about their racism anymore. And so on one hand, I want to say thank you for agreeing to be in this conversation and walk with us in this time. At the same time, I'm incredibly mindful. You know, at first I was taken aback by that because, you know, we open up a conversation about the LGBTQ community and inclusion. And one of the things that well-meaning people say is, well, we should have some of those people come and talk to us about their experience, thinking that's going to be helpful, redemptive, right? Sure. Thinking that's going to change minds and change positions. And while it's true that relationships, back to your first conversation with us, relationships on a personal level do change relationships and change perspective,
right,
or can. So I'm wondering if part of the redemptive for who question has to do with also the community saying, you know, we're not responsible for educating you anymore. Is that it?
Gotcha. You know, language tells everything. So when people say those people, that already says there's us against them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I read not too long ago, Kwame Anthony Appiah wrote a small piece on race. And one of the things that he suggests to us is that there are two kinds of races. There are extrinsic races and intrinsic races. Extrinsic races are people who were nurtured, cultivated in a racist, anti-everybody society. But as they get older, they grow. And I'm talking about in our churches too, that they grow and they realize that to stand against racism is more than to articulate my five black friends. That it's about seeing how the system is racist and that racism is systemic. And the more they learn, the more they change until finally they see themselves as warriors in their own lives against racism. The others are intrinsic racists who have been taught all that garbage. But no matter how much information you give, how many talks you have, on and on, they don't change. And they won't change. They are comfortable. And in fact, now with the growth of white supremacy and groups and white supremacist groups in this country, not only are they comfortable in their racism, they are aggressive in their racism. That no matter what you say, you're not going to change it. I think those kinds of intrinsic, extrinsic folks are in all of the conversations that we have about oppression, race, sexism, homophobia. There are both intrinsic and extrinsic folks. So how is it redemptive? Well, yeah, I think, I hope conversations like these that people have for those who are struggling with the issue of race, that it will motivate them to make a change and that to see the faith as an opportunity and an avenue for change. I hope that those who are and have been, I mean, I'm thinking about people like Mahalan, who's an Anglo woman who's sitting at the counter in the sit-in, the famous picture, all African-Americans, one Anglo woman sitting in the midst. I hope that her witness helps some other folk who still have a crack in their mind to receive information that is not just about those black people, those people, it's about us people, Forgive the grammar, but you get the point. And it's about all of us. In the same way with the LGBT. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, gang, I get a lot of pushback when I give these conversations, and thank you again for allowing me to do it, and other churches, when I give these conversations, particularly with my African-American colleagues, they are fine when we talk about race. They are fine when we talk about women. Eh, a little uncomfortable, but they're all right. But you start talking about gay people, suddenly, oh, no, they want to literalize the biblical text to the point that they are able to substantiate, not gay people. God loves everybody, but not gay people. And going back to, I'm sorry, I think it was Erica, that if we're going to be about a new liberation, we also have to include, stop talking about all of them and all of us, but it's all of us, all of us. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, could you imagine what it's like to be a person of color and gay? Mm. Anyway. Mm. We got to start working toward a wrap up. Again, you all, thank you. Are there any other questions? I hope this has been helpful to you.
Anybody who has a question, you can also press on your space bar or otherwise unmute yourself so you can ask the question yourself. Have a comment from Larry.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Larry. What I seem to remember from early.
Where do we go from here, Dr. Dawson? How can those of us in an Anglo church support the whole idea of coming together, working on our incipient racism, and supporting people of color or of gender identity or whatever? How do we really get involved to support what you say you need, not what the answers are that we might give you?
I think everybody in every community of faith has to start with the following question to answer the question: where do you want to go? Now, we talk about being inclusive, integrated churches.
We'll be able to get a recording of this.
But where do you want to be? How inclusive do you mean by inclusive? So watch this. So, ladies and gentlemen, over the past couple of years, I've done a number of these, and I'm really appreciative because it gives me an opportunity to get my voice out, to get reaction, and then work on my own work. But the fact of the matter is, if my name was Pookie and I had all the experience that I've had and lived experiences with these issues, and did not have a PhD behind my name, would as many people still ask me to come? Same with the question of where do we go from here? How far do you want to go? So, and I mean no harm, but I think you really have to think about it. I hear churches for 40 years, I've heard churches say, evangelism is important. We want more people in our church. What kind of people? Do you want Chiquica, who curses every other word, be a member of your congregation? But are you willing to change the music? Because y'all know how music is so important to congregations, such that you've got somebody, not just Marcus Ruff, who is a marvelous musician and singer in this town, but Miss Bertha, who gonna break out with an old me to him and a shown up gospel song, because my experience has been, we want people to be part of us, and we want go from here, as long as it doesn't cost me giving up part of who I am to get there. So the question is, where do you want to go? How far? Well, most of us are getting younger, and so how far? Are we really willing to stand and make sure that voter rights are maintained? Or how about this? How long we want to sit in the courtroom and watch Pookie and Ray Ray and Shaquika and Juan and Julio go to jail? And what are we going to do about changing the bail bond system? I mean, listen, everybody knows that Tracy Kleekamp Wilson can irritate the devil out of you. Same as somebody. But she's right. And so when you say, where do we go from here? How far do you want to go? Some of you are leaders within the Lutheran Church. When's the last time you demanded of the bishop and the conference, et cetera? Look, we need more people of color to pastor. And by the way, not send them to real little inky dinky churches talking about, oh, see, we got some black clergy in our denomination. Send them somewhere that they can have the resources to do the work. And then don't punish them when they do. I'm sorry. I got a whole bunch of these. But I think it starts with the question, and thank you, the champions. Thank y'all. I really think it starts with, how far do you really want to go?
I do have, and we don't have hardly any more time, but I do want to just put this one last one kind of out there, a theological question. Yeah. Lynn says, what I seem to remember from my early instruction is that Jesus' redemptive suffering was unique. No human suffering could be redemptive. So her understanding of nonviolent resistance was that it was intended to be persuasive. And part of what I heard you raising was that the question of, is there a limit to the persuasive authority of nonviolent resistance? But
right.
So an observation and a question, I guess.
Sure. So to answer you, Lynn, back in the days of the dinosaur, that's what they told me too. And then I realized that wasn't true. It was the redemptive act of Jesus, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. Notice the male language. That's the way I was taught. And so Jesus' redemption is the redemption that covers the whole wide world. But you gotta remember the context in which we were taught that. We were taught that, one, with a white Jesus, two, for a white world, three, and that all other folks was left out. What I began to understand is, and pay attention to, remember Jesus said, there are those who will come after me, the greater things they will do than I have done. And that maybe what has happened is the participants within the body of Christ, we are sacrifices not only to be persuasive, because then you run into an intellectual problem, an epistemological problem, which is, what do you do with institutions that refuse to be moved by moral persuasion? That there's something about the very sacrifice in which we give fulfills also and participates in, symbol, the very redemptive act of Jesus. And so, yeah, it is redemptive. When those women were tortured at Tiananmen Square, it was a redemptive act, not just persuasion. When over 100 Muslim women were raped a day in Bosnia, that wasn't just persuasive, it was redemptive, some way. So that's where I am in my theological position. Thanks for the question.
Sure thing. We've got people trying to get into worship already, and so I need to help us transition. Thank you. Thank you for this whole series. Thank you for raising questions and offering perspective
Thanks.
And challenging us to see through through eyes that are not our own, in so many ways.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for joining St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Columbia and Dr. Dawson for this four-part series titled Conversations on Race. If you'd like to join St. Andrew's Lutheran Church for worship or have any questions regarding this and other recordings, please visit saintandrewslutheran.org. That's SAINT, andrewslutheran.org. Until next time, thank you for listening. Have a blessed day.